From Chicago, this is Cinecast, brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/cinecast. And also by Big Love from HBO, a bold new dramatic series that explores the complicated life of a modern-day polygamist. Big Love. Polygamy loves company. Premieres this Sunday, March 12th at 10 p.m. 9 Central, immediately following The Sopranos, only on HBO.
Thanks for tuning in to Cinecast. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren. Coming up on this Friday edition of Cinecast, our top five cop movies, plus listener feedback and music by Dag Shaw and Alejandro Escovedo. But first, the final film in our overlooked auteurs marathon, Yasujiro Ozu's Floating Weeds.
Floating Weeds, an update of Ozu's 1934 film, A Story of Floating Weeds, a silent film. And this one, Sam, the term floating weeds, the phrase, the Japanese term for wandering actors or itinerant actors. Yes, Yukigusa, I believe, is the actual official title of the film. And it is a story about actors. A master, the person who runs this troupe, he has a show, a kabuki-type program that they come to this little sleepy seaside town that has some history for some of the characters, or at least the main character, the master of this troupe. And they come to it, try to put on their show. It's basically a flop, and all of these family kind of conflicts come out, much like a film like Tokyo Story, which we discussed last week, where eventually some drama is really built up, and we get some conflict out of the fact that this master actor, he has a son that lives in this town, and the mother of this child, a former lover of his, and this causes some problems for his current mistress, his girlfriend, who discovers them, and as it turns out, that this son, he believes that actually this actor is his uncle, and they want to keep this charade going, and it doesn't work. The charade eventually falls, and we get some great drama out of that. And Sam, you talked about Tokyo Story, that it started out very slow, but by the end of it, you were really convinced that this was a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. You wondered if we were going to see a similar masterpiece in Floating Weeds. Did we?
I'm just waiting for the suspense.
Yeah.
With Floating Weeds, it's at once like more, it's easier to get into. And so it's more accessible, I think, at the beginning. I mean, it's not that this really matters, but it is in color. There's a lot more energy from the actors. I mean, this is an itinerant group of actors. And so they wear their personality a bit more on their sleeve. So there's more dynamics between the characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked about Tokyo Story. Really, the first 40 minutes or so of the film is really just like daily Japanese ritual as this, you know, this elderly couple comes and visits their family. In this film, yeah, you get some motion. I mean, you get this itinerant troupe coming and doing a parade through town, and they're interacting with the people in the town, and so it's at once more accessible in that way. You know, it didn't bore me, or it didn't require my patience really so much. But at the same time, as it was going on, I found it less profound in some way. So I felt going through it that it was going to be, I wouldn't quite be able to put my Sam Hallgren masterpiece stamp of approval on this film. And yet the last scene is so devastating and so completely unbelievable. You realize really the power that Ozu builds throughout this film. I mean, really, where you're sort of being distracted, not by any flourishy subplots or anything like that, but just, again, he's just observing these characters. And again, he doesn't really make clear from the beginning the relationships between the characters. You sort of have to just sort of watch and find out. And really by the end, like you said, you have the master having had the split with his current mistress because he's gone back and developed a relationship with his old mistress, who he hasn't seen in like 12 years, hasn't seen his son in 13 years. Obviously the current mistress is very threatened. And you have this really explosive emotional scene in the middle of it between the master of the kabuki troupe and his current mistress. And it's really like, it took me out of it in a way because it was just so unusual to see. You get these two people really yelling at each other. I mean, this wonderfully composed scene where you have it's a downpour and they're standing on opposite sides
of
this soaking wet, you know, flooding street. And they're having this very emotional conversation. I mean, the kind of conversation we're just not used to seeing in the two Ozu films we've seen. And yet, like I said, I mean, there were moments where I was both found myself more taken with the film and yet less just because it was so dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end, I really feel like there's no other filmmaker like Ozu that I've had any experience with. It makes me by the end really want to go back and revisit the film from the beginning and see other Ozus. I'm just really blown away by this discovery of mine.
Uh-huh.
And I was listening to a bit of the commentary track, which is done by Roger Ebert, actually. And he says, you know, sooner or later, all film lovers come to discover Ozu, and you just feel like a whole new door is opened. I mean, he points out the fact that, like, you know an Ozu when you see one. I mean, just like a Hitchcock or a Fellini or a Bergman. I mean, you take a look at one frame and you know what it is. So.
Yeah, you do, absolutely. And I agree that I wasn't as taken with this film as I was Tokyo Story. And I can't really articulate why. I agree with you that it's immediately more accessible because the characters are more dynamic and there's more of a plot than a film like Tokyo Story. And you've got that same static camera, which at first seems boring, but then becomes kind of its own fascination to watch how he uses edits and how he cuts between scenes and people talking in a scene rather than having the camera do a lot of the work. And I love, too, how this film dealt with the topic of modernity the same way Tokyo Story does, but less blatantly. I thought it was really fascinating how, for example, this troupe fails. This show fails. Nobody wants to come out and see the show. And it turns out that the son, this illegitimate son, is the one who articulates it. He says that the problem is that nobody can relate to these characters anymore. These characters in this town and these actors are putting on a show that even the people in this sleepy town, it's not Tokyo, but even the people here in this town recognize this as an old-fashioned, out-of-date, you know, it just doesn't fit. It's anachronistic. And this type of performance, they can't relate to these characters. And I thought that was a really fascinating moment. And the other thing I love that, again, we see in Tokyo Story so well is subtext. The way these characters constantly are saying things on the surface that belie something much deeper going on. And there's a moment where, and again, I could be wrong, I don't know, Ozu doesn't spell this out for us, but there's a moment where the master is talking to his old mistress, the mother of his child, and she says, "I've always wanted to go back to Shingu." And there's something about the way she says it and the look on her face and the look on his face. And she follows it up with a line about some kind of inn, that there's a place there that's changed. You know, things have changed. This, again, this discussion of how things change. And there's something about that conversation that you can't help but think, maybe this was a town that had some meaning for them. Mm-hmm. She says, I've always wanted to go back there. And just all of a sudden, you watch this, the way they interact with each other and the things they don't say. And you realize that something as harmless as that line, "Oh, I've always wanted to go visit that place," it somehow has so much more to it than what it does on the surface. And there's a great moment, too, where later in the film, the main character, this master, you realize, and we're just not going to butcher his name. We're going to keep calling him the master here, basically. He has this moment where we see how ungrateful and disloyal he can be to this woman, to his mistress now, just treating her with total disrespect and being disloyal to her, even though she's been loyal to him this whole time. And the next scene, we get three of the actors in this group talking about how they can't leave the master, and they're not going to leave him, because loyalty is key. You have to be loyal. And that kind of irony, that contradiction that Ozu minds so well of these characters being true to someone who we've just seen not be true to someone else he should be true to. I love moments like that.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't say enough how well he just captures everyday speech. I mean, no note of any line just feels out of place. It never jars. It's just got this perfect pitch, like the entire film. And I think and I was listening again, Ebert points out the fact that his actors have pointed out, like, they would be acting in a film and not realize they were acting at all. I mean, really, he wanted to remove any acting from the film. They were almost vehicles for the lines. And it's almost like one of his favorite actors, you know, by the end of seeing something like Tokyo Story, only realized what a good performance he'd given until, you know, by seeing it at the end.
Yeah.
You know, and it really is, what you see is just, there's no attempt for him to, you know, draw any specific attention to any particular plot point or any particular emotion. And you just trust that just by watching it and observing it, it will reveal itself. And I feel like I just don't see that in movies.
No,
you're
right.
You just don't see it.
No, you don't. And I also thought that another great moment, and again, you talk about just his ear for dialogue and the way he gets things right, and it goes back to this idea of irony and people just not getting it sometimes. That's really what you see with these characters, people saying things, and then it really revealing, by the end of the film, a sort of hypocrisy. And that's what Ozu lets out, he reveals through these characters. And there's a great moment where the son has run off with one of the female, you know, actors in this troupe. They've eloped after she at first seduced him. And the master says to his old mistress, the one who he impregnated and then ran off, he says, "Young people are so reckless." without a hint of irony. Like, right. He doesn't realize at all that he was that kid, you know, however many years ago. And what did he do? You know, how reckless was he to get a woman pregnant and to leave and whatever not? But he doesn't realize that, you know, and it's just those kind of little touches where characters say things like that and they just don't get it. But there's that irony there. And Ozu doesn't go out of his way to draw your attention to it. You really have to be paying attention to the subtleties of the character's performance or lack of a performance. Right. And some of the lines they say and the pauses, mm-hmm. you know, the pauses are just as important in this film as the words they say sometimes.
Yeah, well, and this may sound really naive, but we should point out, I don't know if we discussed it in Tokyo Story, when two characters are speaking to each other, really what you see is the character speaking directly to the camera, which is really disconcerting. He doesn't use that traditional technique of having mm-hmm. that cross-cutting. And there's something really just incredible to see, just like the very blank stares or just people smiling directly at the camera. And of course, you understand intuitively that they are speaking to each other. But there's almost, it got me thinking, and I think maybe it's the fact that it shot from this tatami eye view from like the below ground mm-hmm. level almost, because as Ebert points out, he doesn't want the camera to have a point of view, which I thought was really interesting. I mean, he just wants it to get out of the way and what you're doing is watching the action. But I ended up seeing they're almost like iconic figure. When you see them, they're almost like the Buddhas that you see, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, as sort of like religious icons, because they're just sitting so straightforward. They're looking directly at you. Their bodies are completely still. Their faces are largely still, and they might say something.
Yeah.
And yet it's sort of like in its calm and its stillness, it reveals mm-hmm. so much. Mm-hmm. And another example of something I've never seen.
Yeah. One thing that this film has that Tokyo Story doesn't have as much of too, that I want to throw in here before we close this discussion, is humor. There are some funny moments in Tokyo Story, but here there are many more funny moments. Yeah. And we get when this troupe of actors arrives, the actor walks in, and a woman there, of course, who he wants to impress, asks him who he is, what's his name, and he lies and tells her that he's Toshiro Mifune, you know, like the biggest actor in Japan, who, of course, you've seen in all these Kurosawa films. And that's a really funny moment.
Well, he's trying to impress a prostitute, really, is what he's trying to
impress. Yeah, and so that's very funny. And, two, the humor of this real kind of... I don't know what the right term for it is, but almost the screwball type comedy of the moment when one of the characters goes to hit on the daughter of the barber in town.
Great
and
scene.
She gets really scared or decides that she's, you know, repelled by him and runs away, and he grabs her arm and she screams, and the mother comes in. And he, of course, has to lie about why he's there. And he says, oh, he's here for a shave. And this matronly mother figure, of course, with a scowl on her face is like, well, hop in the seat. I'll give you a shave. And, of course, he is thinking exactly what we'd be thinking in that situation. Maybe I don't need a shave after all.
My beard hasn't really come in yet,
he says. And it's hilarious. Yeah. I mean, it's really a funny moment. And there are quite a few moments like that in the film.
I was interesting to read, too. Well, not read, but have Roger Ebert whisper into my ear with the commentary track, you know, that Ozu, who seems to me so traditional, so caught up in depicting daily, you know, contemporary Japanese life, loved American films and pointed out this one scene when we first have these characters go to this this house of prostitution, and we have this one prostitute who's really quite hideous. Like, she's got this horrible mouthful of teeth.
Yeah.
And she's wearing just a slip. And he said, I mean, Ebert suggests like that shot, and we see she's got dark brunette hair and she's wearing the slip. He's making you know, that shot is taken directly from Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Elizabeth Taylor. Like, that this shot was exactly the same,
which had come out
the year before. You can sort of see it as you picture it in your mind. And so it's interesting to know all these little things about Ozu that he wasn't just this traditional, you know, caught up in the world of contemporary Japanese life.
He's breaking taboo a little bit from time to time. Yeah, without a doubt. And of course Liz Taylor, the same craggly teeth.
Yeah, just
snaggletooth, right?
Red as old snaggletooth.
All right, well, look for films by Cinecast Overlook.Tour, Sam Fuller, Andrei Tarkovsky, and Yasujiro Ozu on PureFlix. Trade a DVD you no longer watch for something you really want for only 99 cents a trade. Sign up for a PureFlix account at cinecastshow.com and get a free DVD.
Next week, if you want to sing out, sing out. We'll kick off our musicals marathon with Jimmy Cagney in Yankee Doodle Dandy. After the break, we finalize our musicals marathon lineup with your help and discuss your thoughts on North Country, Mrs. Henderson Presents, and more. Back in a moment.
Sunset and evening star, and one clear call for me, and may there be no moaning on the bar when I put out to sea. When I put out to sea, when I put out to sea.
Welcome back to Cinecast with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. And before we get into the mailbag and also go through our musicals marathon lineup, I wanted to quickly, Sam, we really wanted to thank a couple of people that we have not thanked yet on this show. We actually wish that we didn't have to thank them, it's fair to say. You know you're big time, right? Like an Academy Award winner when you have to thank your lawyers,
right?
But we really need to just take a second to thank our lawyers, Jason Bent and Michael Smith from Smith & Bent. You can check them out if you have any legal needs.
Definitely.
It's smithandbent.com. Highly recommended. Yep. But they are our counsel, and they've been very patient with us and very helpful with us through this entire process
of the name change.
Coming up with a new name, because part of it is there is a legal perspective to this. We have to make sure that whatever name we choose isn't going to violate someone's trademark, obviously. So they've been very helpful, as has been Frank Terranella, who is a longtime Cinecast listener. Goes back to June 2005, I believe, he started listening to Cinecast and has been a big fan of the show, is a lawyer at a firm in New York, and like I said, big fan of the show and very familiar with trademark law, and has been invaluable in going through some of our naming suggestions and choices that we've thrown at him. And we really couldn't have done any of this without those people. So,
yes, thank you.
We have
and
to say
I think
thank you.
He's inventing existing trademark law to keep us from using Burn Hollywood Burn.
He
I
may
think
be.
He's going to locate it for me. I'm paying him an extra like $75.
He's going to find a way just for you, Sam. So anyway, thank you to those people and the Musicals Marathon.
So we do want to thank the Academy and as well as our
and partner, our attorneys. Okay. The Musicals Marathon. We last week on the show said, okay, we have six we definitely want to watch, but maybe eight films. Yeah. What do you think? And if we went strictly by listener reaction, it turns out that we got more people, I think, voting for doing a full-blown eight-week marathon than six, though there were a number of people who said, forget six, you could do four, and I'd be happy.
Yeah.
There were quite a few like that, but more people said, 8 weeks, go for it. I love musicals, or I've always wanted to watch a lot of musicals. This will be great. Nevertheless, we're going to go with six.
Yeah.
We do feel like maybe you can beat a topic too much. We've been doing six with our past three marathons, everything other than the Westerns when we started, and really six is probably enough for a topic. So we're going to do six films, and the two films we were going to leave out, Sam, from the list of eight were Swing Time, the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movie, and also The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. We were the French musical with Catherine Deneuve. We were thinking about leaving those two films out, and as it turns out, we've changed our mind a little bit, right? I mean, we basically realized that, one, we'd rather watch Swing Time than Meet Me in St. Louis, because we already have one Vincent Minnelli film, An American in Paris, and we'd like to see an Astaire Rogers film. So we're going to watch Swing Time. And if you're wondering why we didn't go with Top Hat, I've seen Top Hat. Right. So that was the thinking behind that. And I did want to see Meet Me in St. Louis, though. Some people were wondering, why did you even include it if you have two Minnelli films? Well, Judy Garland.
Yeah.
We don't have a Judy Garland film. I wanted to check one out, but I'd rather see Astaire and Rogers. And you would agree, Sam?
Absolutely, yeah. So
okay.
So we've dropped Meet Me in St. Louis and dropped the Garland, and also dropped the Liza Minnelli Cabaret.
We decided to drop Cabaret, not because we don't really want to see it, but because as the last film in the bunch, we realized that we could keep Cherbourg on there and have musicals that span from the 30s through the 60s, and Cabaret perfectly sets up as a starting point for another marathon, the kind of neo-musical down the road. You start with Cabaret in the 70s and work up to today, and you could have films like Moulin Rouge in there, though I don't know if that would be in there, Sam. A lot of people were like, where's Moulin Rouge? Said that you admitted you need to revisit
the film. I do need to revisit the film. Yeah, I mean, I saw it in a really bad version. You know, I think it was like a, you know, a copied VHS cassette. But again, so yeah, that's a film I need to revisit, but I'm not sure necessarily. I think there are a lot of just the listener feedback that we got about the musical marathon made me realize that this is absolutely worthy of maybe a second marathon.
It is.
There's just a ton. It's just a rich. It's a minefield.
I agree. But to answer that
minefield,
question,
that would be negative.
No, that'd be negative.
A gold mine.
A gold mine.
Yeah.
Nicely done.
Yeah,
Moulin Rouge, though, is a film that we left off because I've seen it. And the goal with the marathon is to try and see films that are new to us. And that's why, too, some people ask, why not Singing in the Rain? How can you leave Singing in the Rain? Seen it, fortunately.
Yeah.
Thank God. We've both seen it and love it. So that's why it's not part of the marathon. So hopefully that answers
that. So the final list of the marathon?
Final list of the marathon. Let's read it here, Sam. Go ahead.
Swing Time, Yankee Doodle Dandy, An American in Paris, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, West Side Story, which you have not seen.
And you have.
And I have.
That's the one you've seen.
And The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Yeah. And a quick clarification there. Swing Time should go first in that order because if you're going chronologically, which we want to do and usually do, but we did not get Swing Time. We got Yankee Doodle Dandy first. So that's the one we're going to watch, and we'll do Swing Time as the second film in the marathon. Okay. We, of course, have to devote just a little bit of time to corrections. And a couple quick corrections from last week's show. You were talking about 1975, Sam, as this amazing year for the Oscars. That was kind of out of the blue. We were talking about Oscar blunders, but you mentioned how great 1975 was. And I said, well, 1974 is even better. You've got The Godfather 2 and Chinatown and The Conversation. Mm-hmm. And I threw in there The Last Detail. I thought that that Jack Nicholson movie was actually a film made in 73. Yep. I thought it was nominated for Best Picture. For some reason, I've always thought that. And
probably
it turns
because
out,
it's appeared in so many of my
of
top,
your
fives.
Top fives. Could be. Turns out the other two movies nominated that year were actually Lenny and The Towering Inferno. So I have to thank Peter for sending in that clarification. And I do just want to say that I didn't research 1974 before coming into that show. No. We had no intentions of talking about years that were great.
No,
I did make a mistake with one of the films. But even if I had just those three films, it stands. I mean, I'll still put 1974 up against any other year when you've got The Godfather Part II, Chinatown, The Conversation. All three of those films in any other year could have been the Best Picture winner.
Absolutely.
So, and we got this one too, Sam, from Andrew, a Cinecrack addict. And another mistake by me.
Another mistake by you. Usually,
this is the Sam Haldren Memorial Correction List. You're right, but now all three of these
are. You know what I really need to do is set you up for more going out on a limb, because
there
that's what I end up doing and I need to avoid doing.
Yeah.
Andrew, confirmed Cinecrack addict, does note, just wondering, when Sean Bean became Irish? He's from Sheffield, England, and his accent makes this horribly obvious. Understandably, not being from the UK, you guys won't necessarily know that, but surely Irish accents are different enough? Nitpicky, I guess, but I couldn't understand where the Irish thing came from. Anyway, keep up the good work, guys. Love the show.
Yeah.
Owen and Phil also sent in this.
Yeah, comment. Owen and Phil also sent this in, and it's funny, he says he couldn't understand where the Irish thing came from, and it's true that in North Country, our review of that film, I made a comment that Sean Bean lets his, and it wasn't a criticism of it, I was just kind of an aside, that he lets this Irish accent slip through near the end of the film, and he wants to know where it comes from. I'll give you the answer. Yeah. It comes from the fact that just the name Sean Bean, to me, sounds very Irish.
Very Irish.
Okay, I think you can give me that. Mm-hmm. But secondly, I realized that I was totally equating him with his character from Patriot Games.
Wow.
Where he plays a member of like this IRA terrorist group. It's his brother who is killed by Harrison Ford in Patriot Games, if I recall.
Ronan, if he had a...
plays this IRA, you know, terrorist or whatever in Patriot Games. Right. And you put that with Sean Bean, and I thought, well, he's Irish. Turns out he's not.
He's from Sheffield.
I'm very sorry.
Quite dropped that character of the IRA. You
maybe
know?
That's it.
I think it's probably
But no offense, please, to Sean or anyone from Sheffield, England. I meant no offense. And this one here from Alfonso, who commented on Tokyo Story. And actually, we're going to read one of Alfonso's emails here about Tokyo Story, some of his comments in a minute. But he said, by the way, I noticed two scenes within a couple of minutes of each other where there was camera movement. The first, when the grandparents have left their daughter's house and are seen sitting on the grass outside a station, and the second shortly thereafter when they have begun walking towards their respective accommodations for the night. Blink and you miss it. And two other listeners, Brant and Rod, also sent in the comment that I had commented that Tokyo Story, I'd never seen a film with no camera movement. I thought that there was not a single shot where the camera did anything. The whole film was comprised of edits, and they're actually dead right. It turns out Alfonso's right, and Brant and Rod are wrong. It's not just one shot. There are two tracking shots in the film. I'm not sure how I missed them. They are very subtle, but in a film where there are no other movements, they do stick out now when you go back and look at it. It is a scene where the parents in this film, the camera tracks upon them sitting after they've made the decision to leave their family and head back home, and then as they decide they're looking out at the water and they start to move to head to the station or wherever they're going for the night, and the camera tracks along with them a little bit. And in that context, they're really powerful shots, really slow, just, you know, very deliberate, but somehow very powerful to all of a sudden see some movement. And I don't know if it just was Ozu's way of accentuating the movement of the characters, the fact that these characters have decided that they've kind of come to a little bit of an epiphany, and they're now going, you know, it's time to leave. And the camera accentuates that. And I really have no excuse. I'm not sure how I missed it, because in the context of the film, they're startling.
Yeah.
So,
and then you look, it made me pay attention too.
Did you see a camera shot, a movement?
It's movement when very early in the film, when we have that shot of the lighthouse and the boat is moving.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the only thing. It gives the impression of the lighthouse.
There are a couple shots like that in the film where it gives you that impression.
Right.
But again,
for the most part,
I'm not sure if there is any real camera movement in Floating Weeds. I didn't see it either.
We will find out next
week. Okay, well, we also got a few responses to our review of North Country.
Yes, this one's from listener Alex Kinesnik. He writes, as I stated in an earlier email, my partner and I are finishing up our Oscar-nominated movies in anticipation of this weekend. Our last movie was North Country, which we watched last night. My partner didn't have the benefit of listening to your show, so he wasn't prepared for the devastatingly bad final moments of the movie. I stopped the movie at the end of the Charlize speech at the union meeting. I said, seriously? A slow clap? We're supposed to believe that in the space of 10 minutes, these miners have turned from foul-mouthed knuckle-draggers to slow clappers? You describe these moments as like 80s movies or Lifetime movie moments. After the courtroom stand-a-thon at the very end of the movie, all I could think of was an after-school special. Did the actors just not realize when reading the script what a bad cliche that ending courtroom scene would be?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but Jared Sorensen chimes in on North Country. I saw this last year on the Ebert and Roper Film Festival at sea, and man, I agree with Yiz. A really well-done Lifetime movie. My biggest complaint, you can do the everyone in the courtroom stands up one at a time scene, and you can do the slow clap at the end of a courtroom speech, but you cannot put them both in the same movie. So I think I think we're all in agreement there.
It made me wonder, because it's a good sort of question that Alex asks about, like, did the actors not realize? Of course, it's not really up to the actors really to decide.
To
it's
decide.
Not like, well, there's this horrible scene at the end, but I'll do the film anyway. But it makes me think, it's like, could somebody just write a script with a really, like, a realistic ending? I don't know if they'd make that movie.
Maybe not.
You have to sell the movie.
Yeah, that's a good
point. And then, it just makes you think about how Hollywood works.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to have, yes, what do people want?
You got to have the powerful ending.
Got to have the powerful,
powerful
ending.
Dramatic ending.
Completely absurd.
We also talked a little bit about Mrs. Henderson Presents, and a comment here from Ron Harshman in Pittsburgh. I just wanted to give a quick comment on my initial reaction to this film. As far as its Oscar consideration goes, Dame Judi Dench did well in her role, but I don't think that it deserved a nomination. It seems to me that it's more of a Lifetime achievement nod than anything else. There were better performances last year that were not nominated, but that kind of thing happens all too often with the Academy, and I've grown to accept that is just how it is. But what really bothers me about her nomination is that it gives the impression that her performance is the best in the film. Well, in my opinion, it's not. I believe that Bob Hoskins really shined in this film and is what made the film really work. I don't think he should be nominated as one of the top five actors of the year, but he was better than Ms. Dench. Sam, you voted Ms. Dench as your best actress winner.
Yeah, I awarded her the Oscar.
I
will argue. I don't want this to be, you know, I don't want this to turn into fisticuffs or anything, but I kind of disagree. I mean, I think Judi Dench is actually perfect in this film, and I think Bob Hoskins, and I don't know if it was sort of shaded by the fact that I noticed that Bob Hoskins was actually a producer on the film or an executive producer, which makes me think maybe this was kind of a labor of love for him. And so I don't know, again, if it's unfair to note that I thought he was a little over-enthusiastic.
Really?
His performance. And I also felt like, and maybe this was the direction too, he was forced to have these scenes where he was just completely fed up with Mrs. Henderson, and I didn't buy those scenes.
Okay.
And it's like he just couldn't quite make those scenes work. So I guess I disagree.
Yeah.
I do think that Judi Dench was just perfectly flawless.
I think that they were good together in the film.
Well, they were fine. I didn't hate Bob Hoskins, but
I wouldn't single out either of them, probably.
Yeah.
So, and also just a couple quick comments on our review of The Weatherman, which we saw, a DVD that is now recently out. Matt Singer in New York, way off on The Weatherman, guys. Sam, you can't conceive of anyone with so little wisdom getting so far in life. Have you been to L.A., chum? Walk down the street and point, and you'll find someone. Sam, I understand everything you're saying, but you're wrong.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, I bet. And also Seth in Fort Lewis, Virginia. I just have one thing to say about The Weatherman, and Sam, these are fighting words for you. Hope Davis, age-appropriate character delivery device.
Used against me. Hope
used
Davis, who I adore. And I have to say, this may be subjective, because I think Hope Davis does bear an uncanny resemblance to my fiance, Carrie. And so I don't know, again.
You're too biased.
I'm too biased. But I do love Hope Davis. And I think when you have, because, I mean, of course, we're using the, you know, age-appropriate character delivery device is, I think, used and should only be applied to Laura Linney.
Okay, there aren't any others out there that are
AACDs? No, not that I'm aware of. I do not think Hope Davis applies. And I think Hope Davis, she's a perfect example to compare her to somebody like Laura Linney, who I think is completely humorless and has no wit. Hope Davis, who, given a couple the parts are just thankless. I mean, especially in The Weatherman, where she's the bitter ex-wife. And I think of something like Proof, where she's sort of this like caustic, you know, it's not the character you like, but she brings, I think, a real wit to the performance and a real depth. Like, you actually believe that she's a living, breathing person. I think the only person, in fact, in Weatherman that acquits herself at all.
Well, you're crazy. I mean, you're saying Nicolas Cage did not?
Well, I think he's Nicolas Cage. I think he was fine. But okay. I think, I mean, if you're looking at somebody that had nothing to work with like Hope Davis did, I think
You're probably right there. I don't know how much she had to work with. So we're going to come back, take a quick break. We're going to get into a few responses to Tokyo Story, the Ozu film we talked about last Friday, and also some people chimed in on the top five Bill Paxton roles.
Paxton.
Yeah, they were upset about some omissions there. But we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, Sam and I flipped a coin to see who got to say,
you
got to
ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky? Do you, punk?
Sam clearly won. Our top five cop movies is next. Stay with us. PeerFlix is a new way to get DVDs cheap. It's only 99 cents a tray.
Adam, hold on. You know, Cinecast listeners have been hearing us promote PeerFlix for the last 4 weeks or so. Some have started PeerFlix accounts. Many haven't. And I think what a lot of people want to know is, does it work? And do we, you and I, Adam, do we use it? Well, just the other day, I got a PeerFlix envelope in the mail. Inside, Grey's Anatomy, directed by our hero, Mr. Steven Soderbergh. PeerFlix is not a DVD rental service. It's a peer-to-peer trading service, which means that in order to get Grey's Anatomy, I had to send another PeerFlix user, and maybe it was one of our listeners, my copy of Hercules in New York, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. Now, let's break that down. I paid 99 cents plus the cost of a stamp for a Soderbergh movie I've always wanted to see, and all I had to do was give up a copy of a movie I got as a joke gift from my mom 2 Christmases ago. Does PeerFlix work? Yes, it does. Give PeerFlix a try. Go to peerflix.com/cinecast, start a new account, and get a free DVD today.
I was drunk, I was down, I was wandering around my bed. I was drunk, I was down, I was wandering around my bed. I called out your name. Call out your name.
Welcome back to Cinecast with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and we did have a few more listener emails we wanted to get to before we jump into our top 5 cop movies, and starting with some thoughts on Tokyo Story, the Ozu film we talked about last week.
Yeah, Lino in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada writes, I saw Tokyo Story 2 years ago. Now that I was listening to your review, it made me think of another movie where we see a bunch of relatives, and we're not sure at the beginning how it is that they're related. A film where not much happens, but little by little the film grows on you. I'm talking about Junebug. One is Japan in the 50s, and the other is the U.S. in the present, but there are some similarities in rhythm and subject matter.
I thought that was interesting.
Really interesting, yeah. But it points out the fact that how Ozu makes it even more unclear, the relationships at the beginning. I mean, certainly Junebug absolutely takes its time, and you're not sure exactly the family relationships. I mean, exactly when the eldest son has left and how he's come back. But Ozu, I mean, it really is. You really just have to sit and wait until it becomes clear.
No, that's true. But an interesting connection.
Great connection.
That I had not thought of at all. And this one from Alfonso. I've just seen Tokyo Story and then listened to Cinecast number 82, which I'd put off until after seeing the movie. This is one of the most amazing and emotional films I've ever seen. I really have to agree with you that this film is as relevant to modern-day American families as it probably was to 1950s Japanese families. The film really made me re-examine my relationship with my parents. I agree that the film is a little on the boring side, especially the first half, but considering the subject matter, I don't think this is a big surprise. Thank you for introducing me to this director and to this film. I will certainly be seeing more of his work. So just like us, we're so glad that we were introduced finally to Ozu. I had seen one of his films before, but obviously at least one of our listeners is happy about it as well.
So I hope there are more out there.
We also, Sam, we did our top five quick Bill Paxton roles, tying in with this is our second and final week of our sponsorship deal with PodTrac and HBO promoting the show Big Love, the new series that starts this Sunday. And Bill Paxton is the star of the show, man with 3 wives. Right. And so we thought it'd be fun real quick to do our top five Bill Paxton roles, and we got some feedback on it. Why don't you go ahead and start with this one from Dodd Alley?
Yeah, Dodd Alley writes, hey, Adam and Sam, I've been a loyal listener of the show for months now. There have been plenty of moments where, as a movie fanatic, I have meant to send feedback on various discussion topics. I never thought that when I would finally sit down and write a response that it would be towards the top five Bill Paxton movies. Nevertheless, I have something to say about this. Many of the titles that you mentioned contain some memorable appearances from Paxton, but I have to admit never being fully impressed with the man. However, I am surprised that you guys failed to mention his directorial debut and starring role in Frailty. I was suddenly impressed with Paxton the year I saw him in Frailty as the God-fearing father that carries out murders because he claims it is the Lord's will. Despite me ranking Frailty in my 2001 top 10, I remember other friends of mine condemning the movie and Paxton's performance. Did you guys hate it too? Am I the only one that loves this movie?
Well, Sam, you did kind of hate it.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, you kind of hated Frailty. True. I did not, and I actually reviewed Frailty when it came out. I wrote a newspaper review of it at the time, and if anyone's curious, because I say it much better there than I can in this time span, the time we have allotted for it, go ahead and go to cinecastshow.com, and when you read the write-up, the posting about this show, I'll include a link to my review of Frailty. I did not hate it as much as you did. I did, by the end of it, have issues with it, but I thought it was pretty effective for a while. And I agree too that Bill Paxton, I think he's good in it. I think he does an okay job as a director, and I think he does a good job portraying the dad. I liked how understated he is. He doesn't play him as kind of the mom, and Carrie is the connection, the parallel I make in my review, what he could have done with it. Instead, he really plays him like an everyday average guy, which is what makes it more terrifying.
Well, see, I always really liked Bill Paxton. I mean, I would never have come up in a favorite actor's top five, but I went to Frailty actually hearing that it was underrated and that I should check it out. And honestly, by the end, I found myself, thinking less of Bill Paxton as an actor. And I think part of it, I had a discomfort with the way religiousness was sort of portrayed in the film. I don't remember specifically how I felt, but it felt like he couldn't handle the complexity of religion and the sort of the dark overtone of the film. I didn't quite go there with him, and I felt like maybe Bill Paxton isn't that smart of a guy, which I'd never thought before.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay, well, I didn't think it was that bad again, because we had a lot of people, actually. Dodd is not alone here in sending in this choice, Frailty. A lot of people were defending it. And so, again, if you're curious, you can check out my review on the CineCastShow.com site. This one here from Steve Payanzek. Number one, One False Move, a great film. Paxton plays a cop with a very conflicted relationship to a fugitive from justice. Number two, Aliens, by far Paxton's most quotable role. Yes, even more so than Chet from Weird Science, and the most quotable character in the film. Number three, Traveler. Paxton stars in this film about Irish-American con men. Number four, A Simple Plan. Sam Raimi shot this film with a tragedy that follows the discovery of a pile of money in a crashed plane, with Paxton playing Billy Bob Thornton's older brother. And finally, The Last Supper. Paxton ends up buried in the backyard thanks to his political beliefs. I wanted to read those, and I also wanted to mention that there was some kind of miscommunication, or people didn't hear us, and you did, Sam, kind of trail off when you got to, I think, your number one, or somewhere in there. It was kind of hard to hear, maybe, but some people were like, how can you leave off Aliens? We didn't.
I did. I said Aliens. Yeah,
you did. Aliens.
I think it was my number one.
James Cameron's, I think, was your number one,
yeah.
But some people didn't hear that, and they were like, where was it? And a couple people, not just Steve, mentioned One False Move, and they were like, how can you mention some of the other things you've mentioned and not mention One False Move? I think it was my number two choice. I love One False Move. It's been
true.
In top five list. So I think it was on my list. I can't remember if it was one or two, but it was there. And another just small clarification, one person was slightly offended that I would actually put as my number one his brief but memorable turn in the Pat Benatar video, Shadows of the Night or whatever. Again, that was my number five choice.
Number five choice.
I had to throw in the little bit of a joke, but I actually did it in a reverse order. I wanted to throw it in, but I was not going to be so disrespectful as to put it as my number one. Okay,
and I think it was somebody in that same email that was saying, what about Frailty?
Yeah.
And I did actually, a listener was kind enough to actually send us the link to YouTube.com where you can actually watch Shadows of a Night, the video.
Yeah.
He is a very minor player in that
video.
Oh,
yeah, it's very minor.
Very minor.
Yeah, no, it's just
Judge
a few
Reinhold,
shots.
I think, actually gets
has a bigger role, maybe. Role. That's pretty hilarious. Okay, top five cop movies. Sam, again, did you cheat again? You throw in some FBI roles in here?
You'll have to be the judge here. I may not have. But we'll see. I'm looking at my top five, and it absolutely belongs there. But I want to note the films that just missed my top five, and I should maybe be a little embarrassed.
Okay.
In my 6 through 10, as you'll recall maybe from Thursday's show, I had Fargo and Raising Arizona, Manhunter, The French Connection, and Blade Runner, in addition to The Dancer Upstairs.
Uh-huh.
Number five is Die Hard. Yes, it is Die Hard. I mean, I don't know. You're shaking your head, maybe in agreement. Maybe it'll be on your top five.
I'm not shocked.
It's a film. I think it's just one of these films that I revisited recently enough and realized that it is just almost impeccable in terms of what it sets out to achieve. I mean, it just nails it. And Bruce Willis, I mean, sort of going back, and I think he's done some really nice, he's had some really nice performances in more serious films. And, when he's coming out of Moonlighting, I mean, nobody was giving this guy any respect. And I think he just I think he's just perfect in it. And I love Die Hard.
Yeah, how can you not?
What, is it number five for you,
too? No, it's not on my list.
It's not on your list at all?
It didn't make the top 10. No, but I agree. It's a good film.
Yeah.
It came close. Embarrassing for you.
All right, fair enough. It's embarrassing for some.
All right, my number five, I'm going old school Al Pacino, Serpico.
Yeah.
Gotta throw in Serpico, Sidney Lumet film. Mm-hmm. It is a classic. It's not as great as some other Sidney Lumet films. It's not as great as other Sidney Lumet films with Pacino, like Dog Day Afternoon, but it is a very interesting film nonetheless. And Pacino gives an interesting performance. This is Pacino, post-Godfather, but way pre Scent of a Woman. And,
right.
and he's playing the character in an odd sort of way. I mean, this Serpico character has a really weird kind of voice to him. It's the kind of voice that you hear at the end of Tristram Shandy, for example, when when Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan are doing their Pacino impressions, Coogan really nails the Pacino from Serpico, which is kind of this bizarre, whiny. It's almost the Pacino from Godfather when his jaw is wired shut. That's how he sounds a little bit in Serpico. And, come on, cop movies that you think of Serpico.
Nice. No, nice. Number four for me is Wong Kar Wai's Chungking Express, which I know you've seen, but
yes,
maybe you didn't think of.
I
really
didn't think of it.
Two films, two short stories, really, that feature cops. Both have sort of had broken hearts, and they sort of have these relationships with women, and it's centered around this sort of this Hong Kong cafeteria, where you have one cop who's sort of, his heart's just been broken, and he sees, he sort of becomes... He sees this mysterious woman in a blonde wig and gets caught up in that story. And then our second story is really interesting, where this cop has sort of been jilted, and the counter worker at the cafeteria becomes obsessed with him, gets a hold of his key, gets into his apartment, and is rearranging his furniture, and gets into a kind of relationship with him. And again, to describe that is really not to get at the heart of what makes this film so interesting as far as Wong Kar-wai's film. And if you've seen like 2046 or In the Mood for Love, I mean, it's really about creating a kind of mood. And compared to those two, this film is much more fun and more lively. But there's something just intuitive about his directing and about his storytelling. That's just, he gets relationships. And so these two films, these two shorts, these two stories in Chungking Express featuring cops, definitely something worth checking out if you haven't.
Okay, well, I'm going overseas too, Sam, for my number four, a film I mentioned a few weeks back on Cinecast that I had finally seen and was grateful for it, and that's Infernal Affairs. Just a brilliant film that is being remade. Of course, Scorsese, his film The Departed, is a remake of this film about two cops who, one infiltrates the police department, even though he's actually working for a mob boss, the other infiltrates the mob boss, the crime world, even though he's actually working for the cops. And the film is then about these two characters realizing their organizations realize that there's a mole on each side, and they give that person the task of finding out who the mole is. So of course, instead of spending their time trying to find themselves, they're actually trying to find the other person. And I know Scorsese's going to do a great job with it. I thought the directing here was fantastic. And we got an email from a guy a while back, Tom, who said, you know, that Infernal Affairs is just blah, and that, you know, Tony Leung's in it and he's the best performance and none of the other guys are as good as him. You know what? He is the best actor in the film, but that's because he's a brilliant actor. But everyone else is fine. And there is just the drama that comes out of this film of these two people, them constantly having to fool everybody they're with and then fooling each other. And the emotional toll that it takes on their characters is really fascinating, and I do think that Scorsese may do actually a better job with it. Because what he'll do that you get here a little bit is not as much character development with some of the side characters that this film kind of just creates as almost, they're almost symbolic more than they're actual full characters. They represent something for the characters. You know Scorsese is going to give these people, you know, their full due. So I'm dying to see Scorsese's version, but Infernal Affairs is really worth seeing.
Something I need to check out still. All right, my number three, these two, I'm pairing them because I think this puts them, this is like they're body checking the top five, and they're going to go into the penalty box here.
Okay.
I think Reservoir Dogs and L.A. Confidential. I know Reservoir Dogs, you probably have an issue with that. It is not about a cop necessarily, but it is. Tim Roth's character, of course, is an undercover cop, and a lot of the catastrophe that happens at NAAA has to do with the fact that he is an undercover cop and that things have gone awry, which is not news to anybody that's listening in the audience.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think I'm just saying goodbye to maybe.
Okay.
I mean, we have to do the count here, but I think possibly, I think L.A. Confidential has got to be in the penalty box by now.
It was in my 6 through 10.
Yeah.
It's getting close if it's not
getting
for
close.
Both of us. Yeah, I agree. My number three, French Connection. I mean, Best Picture winner, Gene Hackman. Great performance as Popeye Doyle. Roy Scheider's great in it, too, as his partner. And, of course, it does. William Friedkin have one of the best, if not the best, car chases ever in cinema history. So, The French Connection.
French
There's
Connection.
Really nothing else you need to say about it.
I'm going to follow up my two previous pairings, penalty box nominees, with a couple more. I have to be honest here. Clute, a favorite of mine,
yes,
a favorite
it is.
Overlooked film, and Out of Sight, two films that feature cops falling in love with people
J-Lo
they shouldn't
be. J-Lo is a cop.
Be.
You're right. I didn't
J-Lo's
think
a
of
cop.
It. Yeah.
Falls in love with, Mr.
You know what, though? I don't think she's a cop.
She's a cop? You think she works for the FBI? I know her boyfriend.
Her boyfriend, Michael Keaton, is
Michael
a fed.
Michael Keaton's a fed. She's a cop. I think she's bringing them to county.
I mean, if she's just a cop, though, how can she be sent, like, on, you know, up to Detroit and stuff? They wouldn't send a Miami police officer.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like she's a special cop.
Okay. You didn't do your research, Sam.
No,
where,
I didn't.
Where was our intern?
But she's very... Well, yeah, boy, this intern. Yeah. I don't know if it's working out.
Yeah,
I think
we may
have to go back and start doing my own research. I'd hate for that to happen, but we may even have more faux pas. Okay, so Clute and Out of Sight. Again, if I can pair these thematically, we have the cops falling in love with people they shouldn't. Donald Sutherland falling in love with Jane Fonda, Oscar winner in 71. Great film if you haven't seen it.
Okay. My number two, a film that, Sam, you just ridiculously don't like. I can't explain it. You're not a huge fan of Heat.
Oh, don't get me started.
But Heat, I'd love to get you started. We should devote a whole show to it because that's what this film warrants. This film is a masterpiece. It is one of those movies that passes that test of, if it comes on TV and you flip over to it, are you stuck watching the whole film? Yes, I am. And I was looking for some quotes the other day to use on Cinecast, and I went through the movie Heat, and I just ended up watching like most of the film. And I watched that scene again, the dialogue scene with De Niro and Pacino. It is a clinic. I'm telling you, it's an acting clinic. That's how brilliant that scene is. They're both amazing in it. They're amazing in the whole film. I don't care what you say about Pacino doing his over-the-top thing. He's brilliant in it. It's this crime epic.
Can you
epic.
Do the one line
you
he does with his head all the way up it?
All the way up it. Because she's got a great
ass.
Yeah. I don't care, though. Oh. It's a brilliant film.
No, it's not. But the thing is about this film, this is a film that should have made my overrated list. In fact, I shied away from that because I knew the vitriol that I was going to get. But,
yeah,
from
and
listeners.
You deserve every
now,
bit of
I've
it.
I've given this movie two or three shots. It is just... None of the performances, the story doesn't compel. I don't find the story compelling, and very little of the performance. I think De Niro's very good. Pacino's overdoing it. I think Val Kilmer is ridiculous. And what's her face? Val Kilmer's wife.
Yeah, Ashley Judd.
Ashley Judd is just, that's where she just revealed herself to be an unbelievably boring actress.
Yeah, she is kind of boring.
I'll check it out again, but really, I feel like I've given this film its due. It does nothing for me.
You know what? I don't think you should bother doing it, Sam, because you're either going to get it
how
or you're not.
How is it about
not. Cops? What do you mean, how's it about kidding. Cops? Nice try. Okay, you're number one.
My number one, I can't believe if you've forgotten this, you're going to kick yourself. Rio Bravo.
Sam, I have on my list Rio Bravo exclamation point.
Yes.
Like, you know you can make the case for it because
John
he's a sheriff.
Wayne is the sheriff, John T. Chance. And I think really the film that best among all these shows the day-to-day life of a police officer, of a cop, of a sheriff in this case. I mean, what do we see him do? Yes, the circumstances are heightened, but he just has to, we see a cop... sheriff, you know, sort of managing his team, you know, and really day to day. I mean, you know, not asking for help when he should ask for it, and really just how he manages this whole environment. And I think it's absolutely the number one deserving cop movie.
Yeah, I can't argue with you because of course everyone knows how much I love the film just right. as you do, and it does qualify. I think it does. And for some reason, I did disqualify it though, maybe because I knew you'd put it on, but also because even though he is a sheriff, something about the westerns just doesn't quite fit.
Oh, come on.
As a cop movie. So I left it off.
Right.
And Sam, no, I'm not going to begrudge you at all including Reservoir Dogs because it's my number one.
Number one.
It has to be. And you're right because Tim Roth is the main character of that film.
It's true.
And he's a cop. So as a cop movie, of course it works. And you're right. We don't need to go into a lot of detail about why we love this film. It is the film. Again, I'll go back to when I saw it for the first time in Tarantino. It was one of those movies that opens up a whole new world of filmmaking. And
yeah.
You start to realize that, you know, as a young person getting into film that there's this thing called the director, and they
yeah.
make movies differently, and you can start to see some of those auteur aspects,
and
the screenwriter too,
yeah.
and you realize there's something different and unique going on there about what he's doing, even if in some instances he's just putting together all of his influences, there's still something about it that is unique, I'm always going to remember Reservoir Dogs and some of the classic dialogue, and Tim Roth, just a brilliant performance. Any movie with undercover cops in it, a lot of times you get this with Infernal Affairs, you get it with Serpico
Brasco, yeah.
and Donnie Brasco. There's a lot of drama that comes out of that. These characters having to play
well,
two different roles.
The suspense of it, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Are they going to be found out? And, of course, that's on display here. So, Reservoir Dogs, my number one.
I don't know if I've ever seen this. Like I said this on the show. Senior year of high school, I actually somehow, just arbitrarily, picked these two movies up at the video store when I hadn't seen them before. I hadn't heard anything. Reservoir Dogs and Glengarry Glen Ross. I saw on the same
Pantheon
night,
films.
Bill, Pantheon films.
Yeah,
you'll never forget them. And I think with Reservoir Dogs too. I've seen it countless times, but it always surprises me because we're really into the heist, and all of a sudden the movie slows down, and we get these great scenes with Tim Roth. You know, before he goes and infiltrates the gang. And these are just wonderful scenes that always surprise me, where he's like learning the lines of the speech and the story.
It's still the funniest line in the movie when he says the MF line, "I'm trying to watch The Lost Boys." That's still my favorite line, like he's being bugged about drugs or whatever. "I'm trying to watch The Lost Boys." Classic Tarantino line.
Great movie. All right. Well, good pick. I'm glad we get to talk about it. Okay. That is our top five, and that is our show. Please send any comments to cinecast@cinecastshow.com or give us a call at 206-203-CINE. That's 206-203-2463, and leave a message. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and much more at cinecastshow.com. And if you haven't done so already this month, please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Cinecast.
Opening this weekend, the Sarah Jessica Parker, Matthew McConaughey romantic comedy Failure to Launch, The Hills Have Eyes remake, and Tim Allen in The Shaggy Dog. But for Cinecast, it came down to Dave Chappelle versus the Russian vampires. And right now, anyway, the Russian vampires are still winning, as we discussed on Thursday's show. So it does look like that's the film we're going to be talking about. But there's still time to vote.
Yes, there is.
In the poll, make your voice heard. If you want us to review the Michelle Gondry-directed Dave Chappelle's Block Party, we will. But right now, again, it looks like Night Watch may be it. Thanks to Dagshaw and Alejandro Escovedo for today's music. Please check out Alejandro Escovedo on the web at bloodshotrecords.com. For Cinecast, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Holgren. Thanks for listening.
Cinecast is presented by PeerFlix. Swap the DVDs you have for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/cinecast. And also by Big Love, a bold new dramatic series from HBO that tells the story of a polygamist balancing the needs of his three wives, their seven kids, and their three new houses. The all-star cast includes Bill Paxton, Gene Triplehorn, Chloe Sevigny, Jennifer Goodwin, and Harry Dean Stanton. Big Love premieres this Sunday, March 12th at 10 p.m., 9 central, immediately following The Sopranos, only on HBO.